Hello, everyone.
Welcome to the Tie Podcast.
Culture.
Competition.
Architecture.
The dirt.
Drinking.
Eating.
Reading.
Thinking.
God, I love the dirt.
Let's not waste any more time.
Let's go straight to the pod.
Thank you all for being here.
We greatly appreciate the support.
Welcome to the Tie Podcast.
Henry, people talk about how to have balance. I don't like that word. I don't think it's possible. Okay? I think it's about how well you handle the chaos of the imbalance. And what's the best way to do that is to be able to just absolutely soak in presence. And so wherever you're at, that's where you're at.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Tie Podcast. My name is Henry Shimp, and today I am joined by renowned golf instructor Sean Foley. Sean has notably coached the likes of Tiger Woods, Justin Rose, Hunter Mahan, Lydia Ko, Michael Kim, and countless other PGA and LPGA stars. Sean is thoughtful, introspective. He likes to think broadly and deeply about all sorts of different subjects, and that's exactly why I wanted to have him on the Tie Podcast today. If you ask him a question about golf, you'll get some great golf knowledge, but you'll also learn something about life that you did not necessarily expect. So I think everyone's going to really enjoy this episode. I certainly enjoyed the conversation. So without any further delay, let's get straight to the episode with Sean Foley. Cheers.
Drinking. What did you say? Dirt? Is that, that's the acronym?
Dirt. That's the acronym. Yeah.
Okay. I like it. Drinking typically, water. I use a supplement called Element. I've used all kinds of different supplements. This one kind of tastes the worst and is the grossest, so I'm sticking with it. Right? I think if your supplements taste amazing, then they're probably made by Pepsi or Coca-Cola. So be careful, right?
Pretty good rule for life, yeah.
Yeah. I had a friend once who told me I was putting sunblock on. And he said, can you spell all the ingredients on that sunblock? And I looked and it was like benzonephamethapine. And maybe you Stanford boys might have a chance. But I said, no. He said, when it comes down to food and things you put on your skin, if you can't spell the ingredients, then don't use it. And I was like, okay, that's a decent hack, right? I have one coffee a day. If I miss it, it's not a big deal. And then I am a Heineken guy. So I have a couple of those at night, Heineken Light. As I'm about to turn 50, I've gone to the Heineken Light. So that's the D. What's the I?
E. So it's a little play on words there. So E is okay, eating.
Sure. Eating. Henry, I might eat less food than anyone you've ever met in your life.
I'm on the opposite end of that spectrum.
Hey, you know what? Justin Rose could eat 4,000 calories in one round of golf.
Wow.
And you know, for me, that would, I wouldn't know what to do. Everyone's slightly different. With that, obviously, part of it's based on age. So as I'm nearing, I'm turning 50 this year. So I think you're what, 26?
26, yeah. So about half that.
Yeah, 26. So that's a different time. I mean, this is the last year where you biologically still just grow muscle, even if you don't do anything, right? So for me, I probably haven't really eaten breakfast. I mean, yeah, I've had a breakfast, but I haven't eaten breakfast probably in 5 years. I understand now that fasting and all that's really in, and, you know, and podcasts have showed people, you know, so many different, you know, opportunities or ideas or things that they can do. But I mean, if you just think about it, until the Industrial Revolution, we were probably always constantly in fast mode, unless we were wealthy. Digestion takes a lot of energy. But then, like I said, it becomes very unique. For example, my brother and I, as it relates to DNA, 98% of us have almost the exact same thumbprint. But as it relates to my brother and I being from the same parents, growing up in the same house. My dad is Scottish and my mom is Guyanese. So she's from the West Indies and my dad's obviously from Scotland. And my brother is meat and potatoes, and I can eat hot curries. If my brother eats a hot curry, he's probably going to go to the hospital. So it's amazing how just even two brothers with the same mom making dinner, doing that, how much more of my origins are towards Goa, and my brothers are all over Ireland, Scotland.
And it is fascinating. You know,
yeah, it is really interesting, right? And so as it relates to food, I mean, I've always kind of been a little bit like, if you can count your calories, you better count your blessings. Like watching people argue over food, I struggle with, because I've been around the world and I know what's going on in the world. And I understand that how many people are struggling to eat. So I don't like I find it very bougie to start arguing about diets. That's just kind of, now, look, if I'm a physio or a nutritionist and I'm dealing with world-class athletes, that's totally different, right? Because you're dealing with fuel now, right? So if you put diesel in a Bugatti, doesn't matter how good the car is, it won't turn over. So when you get to high performance, then it definitely plays a role. But as it relates to like everyday, and then I think the unfortunate part with food, knowing the low cost of certain food, is that it's just people just ingesting poison, right? So if I had to pick what I wanted to eat all week, there would be some fish in there, some beef. Chicken is an interesting food because chicken is like really something that's been propagated into us. It's so healthy for us. But I don't think the way – remember, when you go to a restaurant, when you get food from – you know, the grocery market, it's probably not a free range carnivore chicken that eats anything and everything. Right. So
right.
It's not, I think with food, you got to remind yourself, if you're in that level to where you're really trying to eat the cleanest you can and the best you can to perform and live well, it's not what you're eating. It's what you're eating was eating.
Yeah,
right.
I've always liked that line. It's about what you eat eats rather than just simply what you're eating. Yeah, that's always been a good way to think about it. I think that's probably a slightly newer concept of people having a greater recognition of the importance of grass-fed meats and all. But yeah.
I would never have ever attempted to even send my resume and to Stanford. But a lot of people that I speak to that guide me went there. So I'm really smart because I'm so smart that all my friends went to Stanford and Harvard and Princeton and University of Toronto and Waterloo. So I got a Rolodex of people I can call who normally have pretty good answers to all my questions.
Yeah, nice.
Right.
So on that front, anything interesting you've been reading lately?
I just got done reading Arthur Brooks' book. It's called From Strength to Strength. Arthur Brooks is used to be the head of a think tank. He's actually a fascinating guy. He did many, many things. He played instruments, was the head of a think tank. Now he's a professor at Harvard in the business school. And he wrote this book called From Strength to Strength. So it's about the two trajectories that a man or a woman may take in their life. So there's the first trajectory, which he likens more to, you know, Western philosophy and Western economics, in the sense of like attainment, achievement, kicking ass, being the best you can be. And then the second trajectory, kind of less is more or less, where you becomes more Eastern. So it becomes like the first part is this, you know, being a self-servant and just completely being selfish and focused in on what you want to do. And then the second part is more in service to others. He's basically talking about, you know, all the people that he knows who are incredible at what they do, who are really miserable in the second phase of their career, because obviously the world values the cars, the houses, all that stuff. When you're in your mid-20s or early 30s, you think that's it, right? I mean, they've told you on TV since you were a kid, this is the dream. This is what success looks like. And then people who really get there realize that they don't have deep friendships. Their family relationships are normally deconstructed. And they're stuck in this place. And so that's probably not necessarily true for everyone. But if you told me that, you know, being worth hundreds of million dollars is a one-to-one ratio for happiness, then I would tell you that's not true, because I've met quite a few people who are really wealthy like that. So he talks about fluid intelligence and crystallized intelligence. So the fluid intelligence is, he talks about cognitive decline. So I think he made a great and interesting, there's quite a bit of data in it. It's not overly data. It's quite an easy read. But he talks about, you know, anesthesiologists and surgeons, and how a lot of the ones that make mistakes are in their 50s, at least over 48. And so regardless of who you think you are, you're, from a cell standpoint, you're in cognitive decline. You will not be as good as you were when you were 36. And that's, you can't put your finger on that. It's just how your brain functions and the efficiency and how it does it. But at 52, you've now been an anesthesiologist for a long, long time. You now have a crystallized experience. So he's saying that if you want to go and continue to be content within your life, go out and start to be a mentor and coach young anesthesiologists on all the things you've seen. So, I mean, it, the book is, it's pretty cool. It's not like mind blowing, but, and I kind of feel like I don't read many books where I feel like I'm learning a great deal. And I think that that's because I've one, read so many, or two, been around really incredible people. And then I've had a lot of my own thoughts. But what's really funny as it relates to reading, Henry, is I met, you know, so many people who have been pioneers or successful in their different careers. Doesn't matter what it is. And as you have, right? And it's amazing how many have all read Viktor Frankl and have all read The Four Agreements, and they've all read Siddhartha. Yeah. Those seem like the three must reads right there, you know? And then I've always been like, one of my favorite authors have always, I've loved to read Noam Chomsky stuff, and I love to read Thomas Friedman's books. And then I've always read the opinion section of the New York Times. Thinking, what have I been thinking about? I don't know. I spend a lot of time thinking about my players. There's what I'm thinking about. Then there's obviously what my brain is thinking about computing. I just feel like at almost turning 50 here, this is kind of, well, it's not a midway point if you look at life expectancy, so to speak, but it feels like a midpoint for me. Just thinking about, you know, how do I want the next 10 years to look like? You know, this just idea of like, Newtonian duality is based on obviously certainty. And I'm more like the Einstein aspect of subatomic physics, in the sense that it's about possibility. And so realizing that we're all so deeply connected, I've said it often, but it's probably impossible to even prove that we're separate, like at all. And that includes everything living. So I've just been really trying to get a good idea, a picture in my head of what the next 10 years look like. So 10 years from now, if I was exactly doing what I wanted to be doing and in the exact place I wanted to do it, where would I be and what would I be doing? And so I spend a lot of time in my whole life thinking that way. And I think that obviously, look, you got to wake up and you got to dot the I's and cross the T's, and you have to stay on top of your craft and all the new findings and all these different things. But I'm just not sure if people create a big enough vision for themselves. My vision my whole life has been gargantuous and probably out of reach. And people would say to me, are you fucking crazy? Like, how are you going to accomplish that? And so I've been able to really, you know, check off a lot of those visions, whereas I've been there and I'm in a deja vu, like, holy shit, like I've been here before. But I have been there before. I've been there hundreds of times in my mind, right? So knowing I did it in my previous, knowing I know how to do it. I know how to my brother calls me the master manifester. It's like annoys him, I think. he's not doing too bad himself, but I've just had a way of whatever I think about and whatever I set out to do, it happens. It happens. Now, obviously, there's the hard work that goes into that, but I think imagination and contemplation is very, very high level of activity. And then you got to be careful, thoughts are energy. Everything is energy. Everything's based on frequencies and resonance. And there's people at Stanford who could explain this way better than me. But so I think, I will always love coaching golf. That'll be something I don't think I'll ever have to really retire. To this day, I sit in a golf cart and watch people hit golf balls and we talk about life and I watch how they react to good and bad and challenge them to improve their understandings. I don't know why I would ever stop doing that. But from a business standpoint, I had some, ideas on, okay, I've helped three players get to number one in the world. And within that time, within 2 months, all those relationships have dissolved. So I'm probably going to be 0-4. Right? I'm probably going to be 0-4. If you told me when I was 25 what the most important thing would be, it would be to coach number one golfers. And it's not that anymore at all. The thing is, as a coach, you don't really have much influence on someone being number one. All I can do is do the best job I can do. And however Henry goes and plays is really not in my hands. And I think that the pay structure shows that. I mean, I charge my players 5% of what they make on the course. So it's like being a consultant. I give them 100%, but it is 5%. And so I've really enjoyed the last probably 4 or 5 years, 6, 7 years, where I've kind of been a repo man. I've had people come to me when they've lost their game and completely lost, and built them back up to a better version than they previously were when they had it. That I've really enjoyed. The problem with that is that from a business standpoint, the first year and a half or so is pretty fickle because they're not playing that well, or they've been demoted to the Corn Ferry where, if a guy finishes top 10 in a live event, that probably will equate to as much money as if he wins the Corn Ferry Tour Order of Merit. But the thing is it's been made very clear in science that there is a number where happiness diminishes as it relates to making money, And so I know that's not the key. That I've learned that, right? And a lot of people have learned that. And they think, well, if I just attain all this, then I'll be fine, and realize that all their mental constructs and demons from their previous life are still there, regardless of the leather they're sitting on in their nice car.
So let's tie a lot of that together. I found that fascinating, the reading and thinking, particularly with from strength to strength. I guess the question I'd like to ask is, so with today, October 24th, 2023 being our middle point, if you go back 10 years, 2013, you're in the saddle with Tiger. And there's been a lot that's gone on since then. And then talking about, the book From Strength to Strength, where you're at and kind of your career trajectory, the next 10 years are probably going to look pretty different from you as you do near some degree of an inflection point. So question being, how have the last 10 years of your life, particularly as an instructor, informed what you want the next 10 years to look like and where you want to be in 2033?
So 10 years ago, basically right around this time, Tiger was player of the year. I Justin Rosa won the U.S. Open. Hunter Mahan won twice. I think the boys won like 9 tournaments in 25 starts. And that was it, right? Like that was the best until my wife turned to me and said, if next year ends like this year, I'm probably not going to stick around. And I'm like, hey, excuse me? This is what we dreamed of. And she's like, no, this is what you dreamed of, but this, you're not you right now, you know? And I think that it's probably just defense mechanisms to just deal with how difficult everything was. I mean, you know, a post 2009 Tiger Woods, it's a different game than it was before that, right? It's just so different. We have to recognize the difficulty in that. And to have 4 players in the top 12 in the world for almost 2 years, you know, the personalities, the egos, the travel. And so, you know, I've been at this point, I've been left with, you know, kind of 2 bum knees and an ankle that tends to be pissed off from time to time. That in the next kind of 10 years is a main focus. What's the use in having all this success to be in a wheelchair in your 60s, right? That would not be very cool, right? So I think the focus now is, okay, I've literally for 17 years, I've put my players ahead of myself, my family, everything. And that was okay. That's part of the deal, right? Like, Henry, people talk about how to have balance. I don't like that word. I don't think it's possible. Okay. I think it's about how well you handle the chaos of the imbalance. And what's the best way to do that is to be able to just absolutely soak in presence. And so wherever you're at, that's where you're at. I watch people all the time be in a room with their family, but they're not really in the room. So it doesn't really matter. Like, you're there, but you're not there. So my wife is amazing. And my kids, you know, the thing about when you grow up and you're kind of on the road and like, they're both, you know, they're both kind of built their own understandings a little bit in a lot of ways, and they're independent, and that's really important, right? I mean, for years and years and years in evolution, for 98% of our experience, we woke up, we grabbed our spears and our bow and arrows, and we went, and we didn't come back till we had food, right? That's why you can always tell that when you have kids, they don't come to you when they need something. They go to their mom because it's not even their DNA to ask their dad, right? Both of my sons know that my wife is technically my best friend and my boss, so they're well aware of that. So what happened after I kind of split up with Lydia, when she got back to number one, I said, okay, I think it's time now to put my career ahead of my players' careers. And so take everything that I've done up to this point, all the success and failures, and the failures lead to a much better speech than the successes. And so I've been working a lot with corporations, talking about brain and mental health, performance, taking people through my experience over the years. Obviously, David Woods and I have created the Pro Center Training Aid for right wrist extension. Those are things I would never have. Like, back in the day, if I had the opportunity to do a corporate event, but it was Tuesday of a golf tournament, I wouldn't fly in Tuesday night. I just said, I can't go to that because I have to work with my players. Well, that's all shifted quite a bit. And I think it makes sense too, because look, being on the road is great, and I love my guys, and I love all my friends on tour. I'm kind of the mayor of the PGA Tour, so to speak. But like, let's be honest, I'll hit balls with Ben On for 31 minutes in a day, whereas Ben On and I will hit balls for 5 hours here in Orlando, and this is where we really get it done. So if I'm being honest to myself, you know, the biggest, probably the best changes I've been able, well, the best, I wouldn't say changes, because change is not always a good thing, but the most players have grown with me as I've grown with them has been Rosie, Lydia, and Ben On. And they've all lived 30 minutes from me. So we got to spend so much time like away from a tournament and working, you know? So when you know, John Rahm's being helped by Dave Phillips, I never really see Dave Phillips. Butch Harmon wasn't out there very much. And he was mainly at, you know, majors. But he also had that thing with Sky Sports. So he was doing that too. It's like, if you get to a tournament and it's a Tuesday and they brought you in, it can be a placebo. They can think, oh, he's here, it's going to get better. And that might sneak us away with 54 holes, right? Because you know the skill is in there. So if you get in there and all of a sudden they feel like they've been able to shut off a bunch of noise, then they're going to have more access to their subconscious. And within their subconscious is a Rolodex of hitting incredible seven irons. Right? So I think that that's been kind of more of the focus is the idea of starting out and writing a book, speaking, working with Dave, being up at Frederica, creating my performance center up there. I'm kind of playing the long game now. It's like, all right, what I want to pour these foundations down to build structures on top. And, you know, as you can see, as it relates to like building, you can drive by an area for a year and see workers all the time. And then one day you go take a flight, you come home a week later and the first five stories are built. So, you know, putting the foundation in that you're going to build the structure on is really the most imperative part. And that takes time and it takes attention to detail and it takes nurturing and care and you have to get the angles right. So, you know, that's kind of what I'm into doing now, but I have really enjoyed like my experience with Michael Kim, taking a guy who was a former number one college player who really lost his game and watching him come back to being the best player that he's been right now. I mean, if I could get it to the point like to where off the course business is so good that I do not need to make money with pro golfers, right? Say I just don't need to do that. Then they're going to get the most. The problem is back in the day when you're trying to, you know, save money for university and for your kids and you've got some players and you don't necessarily agree with how they're living or what they're doing or what they're working on. Sometimes you work more to keep your job than you do to do your job. And that's no man's land. That's not a good place to be, right? Whereas I feel like now if I can get to that economic freedom, I can be completely authentically exactly you're being in, like what you're doing is not going to create better scores. This is ridiculous. You have too many people around you. You're this, you're that. And then say, look, this is how I feel. If you're into it, let's go. If not, have a great one. So you're not, look, time is at 26, you're going to live forever. There's so much time. But time is not infinite. And you just don't want to waste time. So that is kind of the change in 2033. You know, my academy would be in full bloom. I'll still be able to go out in the sun for at least 5 hours a day, have time to exercise, have time to have my meaningful relationships. I think that the boys would be gone by then too. So Kieran is 12 and Quinn is 15. So that would be 10 years from now, Kieran would be graduating college. So I'd probably be living my best life by then because the goal is when he leaves school is they're going to come back at Thanksgiving and realize we moved, but we didn't tell them where we went, Henry. So hopefully, yeah. You know, traveling the world and doing, you know, and going and sharing, you know, going educating, you know, PGAs in every different country, hoping that there's still a world. We are in a pivotal time right now that I think is people are on Instagram arguing about the best rap album of the year and on TikTok watching meaningless shit that we don't really realize how tricky this is right now.
Yeah, I agree. You know, you talked a lot about time there. I do want to ask, when you were working with Tiger, what percentage of your time and almost more importantly, mental energy was being allocated towards Tiger for those four-ish years, if I'm correct, that you guys were together?
Not a lot. I mean, he was pretty much the easiest person to ever work with, right? He knew what a coach's role was. He knew the minimal aspect of that. Tiger did what Tiger does, and why wouldn't you? Do you really teach Tiger? Probably not. About life, maybe. Definitely not about golf. So Tiger was quite, Tiger every day sent a text saying, thank you very much. Not many people have ever done that. All the girls knew that, but not really the boys.
That doesn't surprise me, but is, slightly unfortunate.
Yeah, it's okay. It's okay. So yeah, not, I would say it took up a lot of my time as it was, being able to accept the noise and all the criticism and just getting beat up every single day. I mean, I remember when he won Firestone, it was the fifth tournament he'd won in 8 weeks. We were miles ahead in ball striking, strokes gained. I think that was the second best year that he'd ever had strokes gained tee to green in his whole career, through all those other years. And he wins Firestone by 7 strokes, shooting even par the last day. And I get to the parking lot in Oak Hill the next week, and they say, Sean, this guy hasn't won a major as you've been helping him. And I just realized at that point that you can't win, right? And that he's
right.
And I wasn't naive. I knew that. I knew that I was always going to be compared to the years when he was winning 9-10 events, and that's just natural for people. Is to when they criticize people, is to go, well, look, it's not like this year. So I think more than that, it wasn't so much the time with him; it was just kind of the mental wherewithal, just to, to just completely be myself, not be concerned by the opinions of people who've never met me. It was a massive learning curve. But I think going to Tennessee State, I went to Historically Black University for college. I think that prepared me for about anything. I didn't find it overly difficult. And then I understood that, I understood that Tiger is one of the most, I mean, what percentage of people in the world have played golf? Is it 1% of the world's population maybe have played golf? What percentage of the world's population knew who Tiger Woods was? Probably, 90%? So, I mean, he's about as famous as you could ever be. As famous as Michael Jackson, as famous as Michael Jordan, as famous as, Messi. So, yeah, it was a super, super, super interesting time.
Yeah, that's fascinating. You mentioned something about a couple knees and ankle. I really want to talk to you today about some biomechanics stuff. That's something I'm really interested in, and I know you know a ton about it. Let's start by, what does your sort of fitness regimen look like? And then I guess also going backwards, when did you really become fascinated with the human body? And then how has that just led into where you're at these days with the golf swing?
Yeah, I think with my body, my own body, it's just really been a casualty of success, right? Flying a lot during the years there's almost nothing worse for you than flying, right? We're not supposed to be 40,000 feet off the ground, right? We're supposed to be on the ground, actually, not with shoes on and not on cement. if you look at how we were designed and how we evolved, hotels, time zones, this is all very unnatural to human wellness, right? They've only been around for if humanity is a beach, then how we live right now is a grain of sand. It's just, this is very new to us, right? And physiologically, all the stimulus is having the effect mentally on people or on their brain. And so for me, my friends are really knowledgeable about biomechanics, right? I know enough to know, basically, I've learned Henry who knows and who is good at marketing. So if my players need, you know, if my, like my relationship with Mark Bull, and I think Mark is the best in the world at what he talks about. And he's at the Bull Academy is his website. And it's fan. If you're into that, Henry, and you've not been on Mark Bull's website, then you will love it. He's an incredible thinker and a brilliant guy. Great, great heart. So I've always known that golf is played, you know, with our hands. And so there's all these debates, you know, hitting down on chip shots, being shallow, blah, blah, blah. Look, people just have time to be upset and want to make comments, right? Like a comment section is you're supposed to make a comment. You're not supposed to then comment on comments, comment on the commentary.
God, and, that's so true. It's so ridiculous these days, the comments on the comments.
I mean, it is, it's just, but look, I mean, I think that shows overall just how lonely society is. And so to me, it's upsetting. We see these depression levels and that these people are at least getting people to say something back to them. You know, so I think it's a way deeper thing than just the fact that people are tribalist and like what they think, and they've been domesticated and indoctrinated to think the way they do. I mean, let's be dead honest. There's not a three-year-old kid in Palestine right now who has a single problem with a three-year-old kid in Israel. They're just not. It's just not happening. Yeah. Look, he might not want to share his favorite toy, but that's just because he's operating out of about 98% out of a chimp brain. So chimps, yeah. chimps aren't into sharing. Okay, so that's why we teach sharing, because it's conscientiously a higher level of thinking about others, right? But yeah. Let's just say when push comes to shove, 90% of how our brain operates is identical to a fully grown chimp. So we're not overly impressive. And so I think as it relates to me learning all that stuff in 2001, I've always been very much like a why person. So, you know, I struggled growing up going to church because I would ask why and the answers were not suitable. Right. Now, if you look at the message of Jesus, which is love and inclusion and acceptance and forgiveness, that makes complete sense to me. I know what those feel like. That feels right to me. OK, anger doesn't feel right. Fear doesn't feel right. Exclusion doesn't feel right. That doesn't feel right to me. Okay, but I think it was the rest of the book, the idea of the certainty in all of the books that freaked me out. This isn't a knock on what anyone believes, you know, at all. People have the right to do whatever they want, but I hope that your beliefs make your world better, making the world better around you. All right. And I can't say that that's true as it relates to religion and politics and these things. Right. So 2001, I ran into Craig Davies, who's been my roommate on tour for 17 years. Craig is a Canadian chiropractor. And I say Canadian chiropractor. I say that being slightly different because in Canada, because of social medicine, osteopaths, chiropractors, physiotherapists are very highly regarded because in social medicine, if you have to go to the hospital and get a surgery, it costs the taxpayers a lot of money. So we have obviously much lower pricing on pharmaceuticals. If you go to, you know, if I go here and get my knee done, they might give me painkillers for, you know, 2 weeks plus the ability to refill. In Canada, they're going to give me a pill. You know what I mean? They're going to give me a pill. So I mean, not anyone to get into the disease care system that we have down here. So
I'm on the same wavelength as you. We don't need to
right?
have people listen to us talk about that all day.
Yeah. Look, it's capitalism, right? It is what it is. It's very, very, very Darwinian.
Exactly what it is.
Yeah, it's very Darwinian, right? I think if you look at the pure theoretical Adam Smith aspect of capitalism, the theory is amazing. It's perfect, right? I mean, even communism as a theory, everyone's equal. Like, the janitors have to do a good job, because if they don't, then we're going to need more doctors. It's just, when you apply it to the human brain, application's everything, right? Theory is just theory, right?
Right.
I know theoretically the perfect way to swing a golf club. I don't know how many human beings I've met who could actually physically do it. I just haven't really seen it. So I think, as it related to the body, meeting Craig was huge, because he would come watch me teach, and then I would go and watch him treat. So I've probably watched him treat pro golfers for thousands of hours. So understanding tensegrity models and, you know, what is affecting what. And, you know, the fact with Craig is, like, if someone's shoulder is not feeling good, the next thing that he's probably doing is working on their big toe and their ankle, you know, and he recognizes the deep connection. He's done an unbelievable job on tour, whereas guys have not been injured for all those years, and he's really saved some careers. So kind of, I leave that stuff to those guys, right? I'm, I guess I would say, one of the original experts of TrackMan. So I've always been into ball flight and what the ball's doing. Okay. And what the ball's doing. So as it relates to, you know, I hear so many coaches these days talking about the body and what it needs to do. And they're just really good at regurgitating what they're hearing, but they don't even know about the body. They have no idea, like zero idea. If I have no idea, then they have no idea. So what I've always been able to do, Henry, is find people that have an idea and that I trust to say, what do you think about this? And they either say, that's great, or no, you can't do that. So it's never really making my own mind up. I've got so many people to reach out to, and I find that's always been super helpful, right? Look, I want my player to be the best they can be. I don't care who's responsible in helping with that. That's my job, is to provide them with an experience where they can see the depth of what is already inside of them. That's it. So I it doesn't matter to me, right? I've never, maybe what was it, one time? I think only one time have I ever been to the tournament when my players have won. I still don't have a single flag sign. I don't have anything like that. I'm not nostalgic at all. You know, that doesn't, I'm into the mastery of what I do, and I'm into the relationships that I build in 2023. That seems to be the purpose that drives me. So as it relates to, you know, my own body, I don't really think it's rocket science, right? Like, if you look at us for eons and eons, we were able to go out and walk all day, every day. We were typically in the sunlight. And so if you look at Stanford, you know, one of the current names in the world of social media is Huberman, right? And I've been looking at this stuff for as long as I can remember, but early morning sunlight, really important in how we create cyclical circadian rhythms, right? Okay, so back in the day, which isn't long
ago. I'm a nerd on all this stuff as well, so you're not, yeah, we're really speaking the same language here.
But the thing is, back in the day, which is, just call it pre-industrial revolution, we didn't have refrigerators, man. We had to get up and we had to go. So it makes sense that our biology is connected to early morning sunlight, because that's all we would have ever had. Sleeping right in would have meant extinction, right? We would technically have had very little on our feet. So we would have been in contact with the earth. The earth gives us obviously magnetic energy. The sun gives us electric energy. So we're kind of electromagnetic, right? I think the problem with the 20th century is pharmaceutical companies have had so much power that people see themselves more as chemistry than physics, but I think we're quite a bit physics.
I've never heard it described that way, but that's right on. That's fascinating.
Yeah, I've never said it that way. So whatever I've been taught just kind of you know, manifested itself that way. Movement, exercise, right? So it's a big deal. Like when we look at these centenarians, I just watched that. Have you seen that documentary on the, they call it the Blue Zones?
Blue Zones? Yeah, I watched that. It's really interesting.
Yeah, well, look, they're they're in hilly areas most of the time, right? They're completely in nature. The food is completely organic, coming from great soil. There is like deep, meaningful relationships that they have. Yeah.
They talk to each other face to face, not commenting on comments.
And so, look, they're still, geneticists will say they've got a whole other reason. I don't talk about genetics. I don't have the depth of understanding whatsoever. So I only really try and talk about what I understand or what I'm trying to understand, right? But I recognize that there's that the geneticists are correct when you watch like junior golfers or kids in school. It's like we're at a time where there's so many people who think they can engineer academic and athletic success much more than I've ever seen. Rather than realizing that, you know, our kids are sheep and we're just shepherds, and whoever becomes the dominant sheep is going to be the dominant sheep. You can't really force that. And if you can potentially, but you probably destroy your relationship. And, you know, for me, it's not that important. Like I have my own life, like my children are not my life, right? Like they're just not. I love them. I love them, and I'm here to support them and do everything for them. But if my little one chooses to become a world-class lacrosse player, that's his choice. I'll provide him with the opportunities to do that. But the only problem I'm going to have with him is that isn't if he misses or isn't if he loses or he wins. It's just how he played more than how he played. You know what I mean? Right. And so if he's yelling at refs or if he's yelling at refs for being disrespectful to his coach or not having humility in amongst the other team when they're having a victory, we're probably going to have a problem with that. But if he scores 5 goals, it's like, I could care less. If he misses, I could care less. I go to these sporting events, man, and I hear these people yelling, and they just, you know, I've had enough time with child development experts to realize like that's just not the way to go about it. So I think, you know, as it goes back to your original question, between Craig Davies and Mark Bull and Aravind and Sapaya and all these brilliant, brilliant guys, Kevin Duffy, all these people I've been around, they've taught me about the body and the energy systems and these things. But as it relates to golf, you know, when people talk about hitting down on a 16 down on a chip or 4 down or whatever it is, right? One, it's chipping. So at the pro level, chipping literally has the least to do with success. Okay. In amateur golf, probably quite a bit more. I go to pro-ams and I watch people slice it off the tee, slice it into the green, and then take 4 to get up and down from a bunker. So I think it's more beneficial there. I don't think being on the excessively steep side is going to overly help them from my own experience. But if you're a golfer and I cut off your feet, right? And you learn to balance on your ankles, right? And then you adapt it around not having feet. Would you still be able to hit a golf ball?
Not as well, but you could hit it.
You probably hit it pretty good. Maybe not as well as you did, but probably be pretty impressive with it, right? If I cut your hands off, how good of a player are you?
That becomes hard.
So that's it, though. See, that's just simplify a massive – let's simplify a 5-week fight on Instagram or golf blogs, okay? I'm not saying that they're not important. Due to the homunculus, so much of the sensory information that comes from our body comes from our feet, comes from our hands, comes from our tongue, right? That the brain has a lot of computing power around those 3 regions. But – when I would sit there with Tiger and Nicklaus, I mean, these guys would talk about their grip. Like Einstein would talk about atoms. They'd talk about their grip in their hands. Everything was always related to this, always, right? So when we see Cameron Champ or Victor Hovland or these guys coming in with their right elbow still bent in massive amounts of forward bend and rotation causing side bend, none with bad backs, don't have bad backs. And then we think that that's a great way to teach amateurs. That's just not accurate. Okay. Like, it's just not accurate, right? Like, every single article is still about early extension. Extension is a power phase, Henry. It's a really important. Like, players go into the gym and do squats and do deadlifts and do lunges where they're working on flexion extension. With, if you look at the extension phase in Olympic lifting as how much weight people can move in extension phase, like, so still with all of the new data we have and all the proof that we have from people like Phil Cheatham and these kind of brilliant biomechs in golf, we're still dealing with the same old adages of your early extending. So stay in your posture and rotate. That's not how it works. Like, that's not how rotation happens anyways. So Cameron Champ has got 70 degrees of internal hip rotation. So when he's in his extension phase, he's going to look more open than anybody else. But that's just how the joint looks. It's not actually what he's doing. If he stayed in flexion and just kept turning, how would he ever be able to decelerate to get all the speed out? Do you see what I'm saying? So it's, I wouldn't say I totally know what it is, but I totally know what it's not. And that's a good place to be, right?
So I have a question to ask on top of that, that I've been thinking about this a lot over the last however many years. You've been seeing so many more. So let me back up slightly. I think that there's been a bit of a discovery here in the last however many years of how to really move the club fast. You see so many 14, 15, 16 year olds who are 140 pounds, skinny, and they know how to turn the right way and do the right thing with their wrists and all the rest to make the club move 180 miles an hour. And it's impressive. It's cool. Ball go far. But I look at a lot of those guys and say, I just don't know if that body's going to hold up, at least with where it's at right now. What is your take on a lot of instructors who have been able to get guys who are undersized and, you know, to liken it to a car or something? It's like, hey, you've got an 04 Suburban that now all of a sudden can go 220 miles an hour. And I'm telling you to just rip it. I don't feel like that's going to end that well, but someone that knows a lot more about it, I'm curious to hear your take on kind of some of the speed revolution and how it pertains, particularly to younger golfers.
Well, I think that the most important thing to understand, like with that car, right, is like with the F1 car, yet the engine is amazing, right? But if you ask those drivers, the most important thing to them is the braking system. Yeah. Right? So if you can't decelerate what you accelerated, you're going to get hurt. And a lot of the injuries in golf come in the braking phases. Okay. So as I'm hitting the brakes to then transfer energy out, boom, 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 boom. Yeah, look, you're not going to play that well if you're injured. And so, you know, there's some brilliant guys out there. Like one of my all-time favorites is George Gankis. And George has probably forgot more than everyone knows. George is amazingly brilliant, right? Andy Plummer from Stack and Tilt, amazingly brilliant. I could listen to those guys talk about the golf swing all day. Very different takes on it, but still a lot of it is still based in math. But still scientific, right? I still fall more under the idea. I've been able to help everyone hit it further. But my focus is just knowing that when we lose balls, that costs us a lot of money. So I'm still more focused on accuracy than anything else, right? And so it's a combination of different things. Like people ask me all the time how I taught Cameron Champ to hit the ball that far. If I was able to teach Cameron Champ to hit the ball that far, okay, I could have flown on my G7 to your house and we could have done this in person. Okay. Cause I would be, yeah. I think I would have more money than Bezos and Musk. I think so.
I figured that's where you were going there. Yeah. Cause those guys like golf, or at least a lot of guys like them like golf.
No, but just imagine if you could get someone to carry it 350 yards. Do you not, I mean, how much could you charge for a 1 hour lesson? I mean, we're in the millions right now, right?
Yeah. There's truly, truly no limit to that.
So, yes, I didn't have anything to do with that at all. So when I look at players, they come to me and I get these young kids, right, who are really, really good, and they hit it, like you're saying, they smash it pretty good. And but I look at them and I'm like, this kid by 18 is going to have, you know, disc issues at L4 and L5. He's going to have shoulder issues. He's going to have wrist issues, because I've already seen all that. Like, my roommate is literally a healer of these types of players. Now, he's more working with overuse, because it's like, player plays golf for 4 weeks in a row. I mean, let's understand, right? The one thing about golf that we don't really give it credit for, I don't think there's a sport out there or a game, sport slash game, that has higher levels of neural fatigue, right? All the decision-making, we're outside all day in the summer, it's hot out, no one's really hydrated well enough, right? If you're looking at daily values on sodium, it's probably not the right daily value if you're in the sun all day. So how many players out there know the importance of sodium chloride, magnesium, and potassium? They don't, right? The Rorys, the Roms, they do. But, a lot, you know, they've learned, they put themselves around really brilliant people, right? But a lot of guys don't really appreciate and understand that. I think I listened to this thing with Tom Brady and Djokovic, and they became quite good friends with each other. But what connected them was their love of recovery. But then, you know, you can turn on social media and hear someone say, sleep is the cousin of death. If you're sleeping 6 hours a day, there's so many people out there who are going to be more successful than you, because they're only sleeping three. And it's like, yeah, okay, I get that. But that sounds like, that sounds a pretty good way to die in your 50s with all your money, right? So yeah, it just because you can do it doesn't mean you should do it. And so if you look at strength and conditioning, right, which you're obviously into, you need mobility, then you need stability, then you need strength, and then you have power. So if you're applying strength and power over something that's not stable, you're going to get hurt. If you're applying strength and power around something that doesn't have movement, you're going to get hurt. So we have to be like, the thing is, when you're looking at Olympic lifting in China and all these areas where they have world-class Olympic lifters for generations and generations, when you look at how they bring kids into the sport, you know, these kids do thousands and thousands of repetitions with like a broomstick before they ever add weight to it. And so they have a very scientific aspect of how they're going to get to build them to where they'll be world class at a certain point. And that is not lifting a ton when they're 13 years of age. Do you know what I mean? So
yeah.
Would it benefit most quarterbacks in the NFL to work out more or watch more game film of the defenses that they're going to play against? It's a good question, right? I think I would want to know my enemy very, very well, more so than just being able to run a 4-3. That'd be nice too, but you see, there's just a different way of thinking about it. So when I get these young studs who come to me, like these boys and girls who are so good, that's kind of the thing I'm looking at the most, is like, how are they doing what they're doing? And if they do this for 10 more years, unless they're a unicorn, where are they going to get hurt? Yeah. And being around Craig enough, I've been able to, like, I have Garrett Higgos as one of my new clients. He's a South African kid who's 24, lefty, great kid, lefty, right-handed person. And so the first couple days I worked with him, I wrote a bunch of notes on what I thought Craig Davies would find when he assessed his movement. And I got 8 out of 10. And basically was like, so the thing is, I know enough that I know what I want with his backswing, with his trail arm. But I also know that this whole sling and everything isn't strong enough. And so I keep seeing him go back into retraction and elbow bend and supination this way. But I also just know that's what he does. So right. Craig and I work together to understand, okay, we're pretty much going to be on the start of this takeaway. To maybe right arm parallel for the next 2 years. You know, he kind of stood with his feet pigeon-toed in, had a lot of tilt in the backswing. and just really looked potentially like he was going to be hurt a lot his whole career. So we've been able to play better already and hit less hooks than he was hitting, but it's very small. Like we're just so, you know, we're going so slow with the whole process because we've been doing this for a long time. And we know that slow and steady wins the race. We're dealing with a 24-year-old. A career is a long time. And so we're just trying to do it right. Whereas back in the day, if I had him 20 years ago, I would have been in there way more aggressive. We need to get this and this, and you need to do this and this and that. But I just think from all my mistakes and all my failures, I've kind of learned like how to not do that again to someone, right? When it originally happened, the intent was only to help. But the problem was I was probably much more arrogant than I am now. I've been humbled enough by the game and by life that I really see the process very quite clear now. And so, you know, if you read your favorite book and it had no commas and it had no exclamation points and it had no question marks and no periods, it wouldn't read nearly as well. Like the grammar and structure is very important in what you're reading. But totally. That would seem to be the easiest thing for anyone to learn. No one could really learn to write like Dostoevsky, but we could learn to have the grammar the same. So I'm not going to be able to build a Cameron Champ with anybody, but I'll be able to, you know, dot the I's and cross the T's that are imperative to be the glue of the story. So that, I guess over time, I just realized that my job is not as big as I thought it once was, but it's become bigger in the sense of providing structure and providing vision and then seeing how it's been done wrong, you know, watching players that I start with now change putters every week, test clubs on the range on a Wednesday before a tournament without even a track man on going, I like how this one Apex is better. Just trying to get them to not do that. Self-sabotage is a tricky thing, right? The person doing it is the last person to know they're doing it. And so just kind of more being, you know, more being a drone and just being able to be high up enough that I can see exactly what's going on. Not what I think what's going on, exactly what's going on. So really, you know, like I've had a player who talked about switching agencies. This is something 17 years ago I knew nothing about. And I said to him, well, why are you going to switch agencies? Knowing that that's a pretty big deal. There could be some legal respite. There could be this. There could be that. That is going to potentially, Henry, be noise. All right? If I have noise, I don't have clarity. If I don't have clarity, I'm not going to play well. I don't need to be positive. I definitely don't need to do that. Okay? I need to have clarity. All right? So I could never have said this in the past, but I just said to him, look, you're not happy with the deals they're bringing you, but you're outside of the top 100 in the world. So the question is, do you suck or does your agent suck? Like, these guys, the number one in the world, this is what their deals are. The market pays based on world ranking, basically how it goes. You might find a company, Henry, that really likes someone and they might pay them a little bit more to make sure they get them. But for the most part,
markets operate very efficiently.
I think so, right? The economic and market world, I do know nothing about, zero. That I have zero understanding of. So, you know, potentially getting him to not do this, which was probably going to play out for the next 6 months. I don't think, in seeing this happen many, many times, it's very rare I see people end up in a better place than they were. And, you know, a lot of us think the grass is greener on the other side, but it just isn't. It just really isn't. So Basically getting him to understand how you play is going to attract these businesses. But remember, you want to be the best player in the world. You tell me that. I do. All right. So if you have three more logos on your shirt, that's going to be an equivalent of 12 more days that you have to give to the corporation to do an outing, which is 12 days on top of travel, delays, that's another, call it 26 days. And you already don't feel like you have much time. So do you want to just have logos and make money that way? Or do you want to make the most out of your career as a player? These are things that I never thought, Henry, 17 years ago, I would talk to players about. It was all just about, you know, P1 and 2 and 3 and 4, and every bad shot was due to technique. And I know it's not true anymore. And when I thought it was true, it was fine because I thought it was true. When I understood it wasn't true, I couldn't stay there. You know, I couldn't continue that way. So I think I see myself now kind of overall as a mentor who used to be a swing expert.
Well, Sean, that's a good spot to finish up. This was this conversation took on a new life, and I was hoping for that. So this was fantastic, and I really appreciate you taking the time.